If you're having bad problems, I feel bad for your son. I got 99 problems, but a ski ain't one.
5 days, blue sky, high pressure, yo. Wind so light, ain't got no flow. Critics are saying my hold is low, but I was born in the hood, so the story goes. My Makota's stuck, it really blows. The hummingbird flashes with a gentle glow. Frable big game with the big old hole. If you don't like my lyrics, you can press fast forward. Blades clanging loud from the other boat. Ripping rubber too big because they think they know. Cut me off hard because I'm fishing slow. Big motor just...
All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 Podcast, a Jaybird.
Steve, what's happening?
Just off the water. Take me to the water. Sorry, I was listening to a smidge of the Talking Heads on the way back here. Anyway, yeah, just off the water. Jay, I don't know what's wrong with everybody having problems catching muskies, because I just had an 11-year-old smoke two in the eight. So it was just...
Wow, ridiculous.
It was ridiculous. Every dog has its day, but it was a good one out there. It was funny watching something, you know, I've always observed guiding, which is kids and people's girlfriends don't really care, right? They're not overthinking it. The kids are just kind of there, and, you know, he's a good angler. He's making good casts. And I showed him one time. I said, here's how you do your eight, right? Mm-hmm. Didn't overthink it. Smoked two of them. Smoked two of them boat side, Jay.
Kids are a sponge. Yeah. They soak it up.
Awesome.
Boom.
To watch, man. Bam.
Nice.
It was pretty fun. But anyway, I just always, you sit there and there's days where I go, well, I might have overthought that one. he was just immediately on. It was just funny because you just psych yourself out. You know, here he comes. Here he comes. Kid didn't care. It was a video game. Anyway, so goodness, yeah. What have you been doing? Is it still horrible cold before the horrible? It's like pre-horrible cold.
No, we had some really nice weather this week. I mean, it's back to normal now, but it was really nice Friday into Saturday, you know, 50 degrees plus.
Nice, that's livable.
Yeah, I'll take it.
In comparison, so, yeah, to, you know, kind of the beginning of last week, what's it? Yeah, first of the week, we're horrible, horrible cold, and then it finally came around and started to, doing the do. I mean, freaking been a good week. I sent you Donkey Kong from earlier. You know, there's been it. I've been just doing so well with Magnus, dude. Just lighting them up. So there's kind of that magical thing. You get that temp drop. Anytime I'm seeing that 55, 54, I am reaching for Magnus with the heavyweight. That's what she was made for. So it's been pretty.
The heavyweight, get it down there and nice and slow. And yeah, sure.
Wackety schmackety. That's what all the guys are saying at the dock, Jay. Wackety.
Original tail, or are you going with the shorter tail?
I don't. You know, we made the short tail version. So there is a version for children. It's fall. It's November. Get out the big baits. Are we? What are we doing here? What are we doing, Jay? Get you a pair. Now, I'm rocking the 10-inch pretty much, you know, all winter. You know, as it cools down, you get in that colder weather period. Don't waste their time. You know, why throw the little stuff? I mean, that's just the way I kind of roll. But, again, I think I sent you the big boy from earlier this week. I actually had a couple big boys in the net, but there was a big, big boy. 10-inch bait. I mean, tis the time of year, you know. But also, too, you know, for you southern anglers, and there's still a lot of open water everywhere. A lot of people still fishing. And, heck, Dr. Bob, he's still rocking out there in the cold. And something to be said, there's a certain point where you're doing yourself a disservice throwing small stuff. And it's the caloric risk, caloric reward. Well, people are always like, well, they won't move if, you know, because I'm always preaching slow, slow, slow. But again, think about that scenario, caloric risk, caloric reward. Well, is the risk worth the reward? Well, make it a big presentation that is calorically worth the value to go chase down, right? The other thing is this, good little tip here. If fish are deep, don't try to drive them to the surface for your eight, you know? meet the fish halfway. Get down there and go for it. It's getting to be that time of year, you know, for me, definitely in Tennessee and anyone else fishing into the cold, into the fall. And, you know, people are still trophy hunting on open water. You got Jay, you got stuff in Michigan. Everybody thinks about these different locations. There's no close season there. You know, I just talked to some people that were still up in the UP, Jay, still doing the do. You know, deep figure eights, get down. Don't try to coax that fish up so you can watch the eat. I've caught a lot of fish figure eighting where I couldn't see the Musky Shop logo on my rod. Right? Which means, oh, on a 9'6" rod, I've got about 8.5 of it down there. You know, if you see one coming in, obviously that involves some live scopery, right? You're seeing him coming on the follow, get it down. But it's kind of interesting, that concept there. Hold on, who is it? We're working on a special guest. Believe it or not, Jay, we got a special guest next week too.
I've heard.
You know, we got a super special guest here in a second. But Gavin, as far as what's going on, me and the old Dr. Bob been chatting back and forth here intermittently, shooting a couple emails there. I talked to him on the phone for just a second. It's hard for me to get on the phone running and gunning, but we were emailing back and forth, you know, about what we're seeing. And something worth note, it is the time of year in shad based systems when you have these schooling fish, and I mean Jamie Pasilli over in freaking over on the East Coast, right? All these places you hear about the worm, right? You get schooling shad in a lot of bodies of water. I'm talking in East, anywhere there's a shad, they're all over the habitat range, right?
Yeah.
You get these massive schools of shad that are very hard to contend with. And that's what he and I have been talking about. I've been doing some alternative tactics, some weird trolling stuff. I'm not willing to divulge just yet. I don't have the tech. I got to get the tactic 100% dialed and then I'll tell you about it kind of deal. I'm catching fish, but I don't feel like I got it drilled down just yet.
Mm-hmm. But okay.
That's something Bob and I were having a discussion today and it really struck me. And it's something to consider when you're dealing with those big schools. And Bob brought this up about a week ago, which is once we're into the low 50s, you do not have plankton. You don't have anything that the shad are eating developing, which I think is why you take that in conjunction with temperature, why you end up with a quote-unquote the worm, which if you don't know what I'm talking about, you will look on your fish finder and it's like you're driving over a 4-mile-long worm in the water. Right? You're like, what is this? Oh, that's
okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Sure. Okay.
And they jokingly call that up where Jamie Pasilli guides is kind of where that's coined. That term, you end up in the water, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of shad gathered up. And, you know, it's the time of year for that. And it's the same dynamic Bob was talking about, the same dynamic you have with people that are on the Cisco-based system. Right. And we're laughing about the old thing, Jay, about, you know, you want to get on the edges of these schools and it's like, well, where's the edge? It's never ending. You know, is it 4 miles upstream? And so some of those dynamics. But anyway, just keep an eye on that. If you're fishing a system with shad, it is that time of year where you will get the worm and you're going to have to adapt because muskies are going to stay right then and there. And Jay, I watched yesterday, right? I bopped around a little bit, went to some other water and, you know, you deal this, you deal that, you know, and had the meet and greets and all this and all that. But nonetheless, you know, a couple days ago out on the water doing the thing, watch one burst through literally the shad on the screen on Panoptix. You're watching here, had nothing to do with us, and you watch it just launch off the bottom, blast into the school. You didn't see it eat, and then they just dissipate, and it's sitting right there, like, ah, I got, you know, basically watched a natural predation there, which is kind of crazy. But, you know, long story short, there are things going on. A lot of these fish are staged just on the bottom under that stuff. But anyway, I digress. comings and the goings at the Muskie Shop, Jay. It's time, folks. You've waited all year long to get your Christmas tree ornaments from the Muskie Shop. What do we got here? Mag 12. This is what happens. A lot of 12 blades were made in the craze of the Blade Wars, right? Until we settled
the Blade
on double,
Wars.
Until the world settled and said a double 10's as big as I'm comfortable throwing. So excess number 12s are being turned into, I'm teasing.
Yeah, those things are cool. We got a huge Willow Blade, custom painted with muskies on them, and a big Mag 12, and they're heavy too. So, good size ornaments, very neat, along with the playing cards. Yeah, we're racking and stacking gift ideas for the holidays.
Well, everybody wants it, and it's actually got a cool text from Jake Smitty. And his son was doing the word search. Somehow, he's a super genius, Jay.
Child. Yeah, he came in the other day. He got like five of those coloring books with the brain teasers in them that I like so much. Listen,
we got their next Einstein because it looks like he figured out the word search. Dr. Bob couldn't do it. But anyway, no, he did that, and it cracked me up. He said he was enjoying that, and then that his dad was playing cribbage with the Muskie Shop cards.
I knew it. I asked him, I said, is he a euchre guy or what? He's like, no, he's cribbage. I'm like, oh, okay.
Don't understand it, don't want to.
It's technical, Steve. It's technical.
I've seen people play it up in Canada, and they're like, we got four, too much math for me. I'm a muskie fisher, and I'm not here to do math. No, it's cool. It's always fun with the holiday stuff, you know, whatever. But, yeah, very cool. So, anyway, I digress. Been teasing it. Got him on the phone. And, guys, we have the world's greatest fisherman, according to ESPN, on the list of the greatest fishermen of all time.
Right. There you go.
Kevin Van Dam's hero. And I have hung out with this guy. And here we're standing at ICAST. And you name a name in fishing, right? Mm-hmm. Scott Martin, Roland Martin, Jimmy Houston, all of them.
Hank Parker?
Sure.
House needs painting. Grass needs mowing. Where's he at? Gone fishing.
Anyway,
Hank Parker's outdoor. Go ahead.
Nonetheless, all of these folks come and visit with this man and acknowledge kind of his place in the world of fishing. So,
cool.
He's actively fishing. You know, all the guys that are still on the tournament trails and all that stuff, they're over there kind of, you know, you come not kiss the ring. He's not that kind of guy, but everybody. comes over to visit with or speak with because he is kind of a lot of your heroes, which is cool. Now, with that being said, definitely he's an older gentleman. He's in his late 70s now, but Jay, he's still fishing. He's still on top of, still active, right?
Absolutely. That's great.
This is not like somebody's granddad that I used to catch some fish. That's not the scenario at all. He's actively in development of baits currently too. So he's a sharp cat. He's not diminished, but he's not a muskie angler. And obviously it's Mr. Rick Klun and a pal here, but, wanted to have him on so you could just listen about his mental game plan. You know, his nickname in the world of bass fishing, they called him the Zen Master. And he's kind of a little more heady, a little bit more out there on stuff. So I pick his brain about a lot of different subjects and all this stuff. But like I said, I don't think we'll have a more important guest on the show ever. You know, so I don't know who you have. Maybe the only way we could top this, Jay, is we just have an actual muskie on the show. You know,
next level right there.
Wire its brain up, right? Got some diodes, got some resistors,
chips and a bunch
of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And you just realize they've just wanted peanut brittle all this time.
Yep. So you wind it up and you don't find anything new or exciting because it's an animal.
Listen, guys, I'll tell you, it ain't about bass fishing. This isn't about anything other than how this man fishes. Check it out. The legend of all legends, the greatest of all time, Mr. Rick Klund. Guys, I have a man that needs no introduction. The GOAT, the greatest of all time, Rick Klund. How are you doing, Rick?
Pretty good.
I hear you. So, guys, I've got to hang with Rick a little bit here, and I'm grateful he's willing to slum it up with us here on the Muskie 360 podcast and talk about some things. Rick, I mean, you know, a lot of guys that muskie fish and multi-species fish, they know who you are. For those that don't, I mean, what are some of how many classics have you won at this point? You've just dominated the world of bass fishing.
Well, yeah, I've won one in 76, back to back in 77. Then I won the next one in 84 when we had two presidents, eventual presidents there, Clinton and Bush. That was a big one just from that standpoint that we became kind of bona fide, you know, fishermen. Yeah. You know, you're fish, when you tell people you're a fisherman, they go, well, that's fun. And then, yeah, but they say, what do you do for a living? I fish for a living. Well, that's when you really confuse a lot of people, you know, because they don't know what you are. Are you setting fly lines? Do you own a shrimp boat? You know, what the heck do you do? Right. So when the presidents, actually eventual presidents, showed up at that classic in 84, then really kind of, maybe there's something more to this than just a bunch of guys, you know, that don't have all their teeth and can't speak the English language very well.
Trying to catch a bass, they say.
Yeah. But then again, I won it in 1990, so I won 4 years, four different years. And Kevin Van Dam's the only one that has done that. He's won four. Nobody else has won over two.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you've also got some victories on the Elite Series up to the – what 70? What were 76 on your last elite win? What was it? Something crazy. What was?
Boy, you're taking me way back there, Stephen. 76? No.
No, well, I meant your age.
Last elite win was actually 2019 at the age of 72.
Okay, 72.
Nobody's
crazy.
That old has ever won a major event. And actually, I've won one 2 years before that in 2016 at the age of 68 or 69, I forget. And everybody thought I'd retire then. And when I didn't, some people kind of got upset mentally, not emotionally, but they go, well, why? Boy, that'd been a great time to pull out on this winning, you know, becoming the oldest angler ever to win an elite event. Uh-huh. And then when I won again, you know, in 2019, they go, oh, that's why he didn't pull out. He wasn't finished.
Well, you know, it's I'm getting to hang out with you, and, you know, we've spent some little bit of time here and there together. Your age is just a number when it comes to Rick Klund. You've got the energy of a far, far younger individual. You know what I'm saying? You're still, that's kind of cool. Guys, you know, it's all about how your lifestyle is. I mean, Rick, you're still out there taking people out, hucking and chucking, doing like your legend events and things like that, right? You're still on the water.
Well, I think what I realized, especially, he really got, you know, exposed to me, or was in COVID. What keeps you alive is what COVID taught me. What are the things that are keeping you alive? And when it's all those things are kind of taken away from you, then you get to really analyze, okay, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not feeling real good. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing this anymore. Those are the things. So that really emphasized to me how important what I did was to being alive. In other words, to most people, you can just say, what challenges you the most mentally and physically? And if you can answer that, then keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, what keeps you motivated and keeps you going? Right. That's just so huge. So, you know, it's so cool that you're so active and you know, you're absolutely, you know, the GOAT here. So it's kind of crazy.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Stephen, I hate that term.
I know you do.
mainly because it's an erroneous term.
Okay.
There's no proof to it. I don't care. There may be in some sports, but in fishing, there's really no proof to that unless you could take a time machine and say, okay, let's take Bill Dance in his hottest era, move him into a certain time frame of 10 years. Take right. Roland Martin, move him into a time frame for, and put us all in the people call the GOAT, Kevin mm-hmm. Van Dam, myself, and others, put us all at our peak in the same time frame, and then maybe you could see who really was the best. Outside of that, you can't.
You know, because, that's a problem very few have, though, because if you look at it, that same you hear the same conversation about, say, like a Tom Brady versus, you know, possibly Mahomes, yeah. or whether it be Michael Jordan or Kobe, so... You know, right. That would be interesting, though. Can you imagine that tournament, though? If you had everybody say, what? Let me, that leads me to kind of a theoretical question, I guess, or just more. When did you feel that you were at your best during your career? When did it all click? Because I'm sure there was a thing when you started in your tournament thing where you're like trying to get your bearings, right?
Right.
And you're feeling, you kind of, I don't know how to put it for guys that don't fish like every day, but. You know, when you kind of lock in, Rick, where you're like, you almost, it's not that you can do no wrong, but everything feels right. Did you ever, when in your career did you kind of hit lock in on that place where you're like, everything was just kind of flowing and you felt mentally at your best?
Really, it was probably, and that's a fragile thing. I don't mm-hmm. care how good you are. You see even Mahomes have games where he can't find it. Mm-hmm. And so that's very true in all things, and fishing is no different. But I think it was in the 80s because, and it wasn't just a classic. It was after I actually won the U.S. Open. Mm-hmm. And then I won the Red Man All-American. And those were all 80 events. And I was guiding. I was on the water, you know. You know this. I was on the water pushing 300 days a year.
Yep.
Fishing 20. It wasn't just BASS. That tends to be what I'm known for. But I was winning more tournaments in other organizations like FLW, you know, big regional events. But that's when it hit me. And that's also when this is the part that most people don't understand, and most people I will lose when I go to this part. But this is when I was really mentally understanding how nature worked. In other words, and how the universe worked.
Mm-hmm.
And then trying to, you know, become totally in tune with that. In other words, you know, that was at the point when I'd been studying every religion on the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Not thoroughly, but I studied most of them. And then that's when I also was starting to study, you know, meditation and visualization. I really spent a lot of time studying Olympic athletes
mm-hmm.
and how they were going to achieve, hopefully, their greatest performance ever, you know, when they went to the Olympics. And they had to pull it all into a certain time frame. And they had that. So the meditation, visualization, all those things started to play a huge role in that kind of focus. And I was doing that at a high, high level. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably when I really felt the very, very, very best in my career. Mm-hmm. And I was basically physically at my strongest point. I was on the water, you know, almost like, you know, pushing 300 days a year. You know, I even at tournaments, I didn't go into a motel room and turn on TV. I stayed in my camper because I wanted to maintain that attunement mm-hmm. that I had achieved all day, and go back and just get in the camper. You know,
right?
And still, and no heat, no air conditioning, and you maintained it. You didn't go back to the room after a great day of getting in tune, and then all of a sudden there was a great football game. You flipped it on. You started watching it. You started watching all the commercials. You started watching the cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's going to take you away from it. And so at that point is when I was probably the most in tune, mm-hmm. you know, I ever been, and I miss it. I was guiding in between tournaments,
mm-hmm.
you know, so... Anyway, that was an amazing time frame because, you know, all athletes are trying to touch perfection on that day they're going to perform in the Olympics or that big Super Bowl game or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got to touch perfection. Can you maintain perfection? I don't think so.
Right.
but you can put yourself in a point that you can touch it and touch it at the appropriate time.
Do you think, and again, the thought process, I love it because I think, you know, in life, you're always trying to be present. You know, if you're living in the past or you're living in the future, right? That's problematic. Right. And I try to do that on the water, which is like, if you can be there, it's kind of that dialed in state of tuning out that noise. And it's so funny because you're saying you were just trying to stay as locked in as you could 24/7. Just tune out everybody, tune out everything, right?
Well, yeah, because, you just said the word present. Here's the hardest thing for most human beings to put in its proper place. Okay, and Einstein basically said it. He said in this late in his life, when he's trying to understand, like I was trying to understand, where does this gut feeling stuff come from? Mm-hmm. I'm going to use gut feeling because that's what fishermen relate to. Because that was the most powerful stuff that would come to me. It wasn't an intellectual process. At first, you try to write it off to your brain's a computer, and it's putting together all the variables, and boom, it's going to give you this perfect answer. But Einstein basically said, okay, the most powerful, late in his life, the most powerful part of me and human beings is creation and intuition. Your creative abilities and intuition. And he said, then here's the most thing you got to listen to. He said, the rational mind should be a faithful servant. That's the key word. But what does modern man do? He elevates the rational mind to the master and forgets the gift, which is the creative to intuitive part of who you are. And in fishing, and why is that? Because first of all, I don't care how much rational knowledge you have, that's all in the past. Mm-hmm. It's not current. It's not current. And then that's where the gut feeling kicks in and says, I really need to move over here and start doing this. And so that's really what started me on my search, that philosophical, spiritual, blah, blah, blah. In fact, research was to understand, where does that come from? How can I listen to it? Because most of us don't even listen to it when we get it, you know. So, in fishing, the only thing that's current is gut feeling. Rational mind's always in the past. It's still valuable if used correctly, but that's when the two have to work together in the proper order. Gut feeling first, rational mind second.
From your standpoint, like you're on the water, right? And that trying to be in that headspace, you're in that headspace. Are you just kind of more locked in on the environment and taking, you know, the ebb and flow from that, where like it feels like, you know, you innately know what to do, or you innately know what speed things are at? You're just kind of you're kind of one with the environment, if you will. Is that kind of where you want to be locked in?
That's what you're trying to achieve, but how do you do that?
Right.
You do that through all your sensory abilities. You got to elevate them to a level that they're not at. Mm-hmm. Okay. In other words, your hearing, your smell, your eyes, your vision, your touch, you know, mm-hmm. you have to become very, so you got to elevate your all your awareness skills, your sensory abilities to the highest level. And nature is the best place for me to do that. All of a sudden you're hearing stuff, you're smelling stuff, you're seeing stuff, and then that becomes it. And you start to shut out anything that would be considered a distraction from that information. Mm-hmm. And that's where the battle is, because it's not easy to do that. But that's where that's the only way you become totally in tune with the rhythms that are going on, the natural rhythms. Is, you know, I know you guide, and I know, one of the examples I can use when I'm talking to college kids is without seeing it, when you hear a fish splash, can you tell me what kind it is?
Yep.
Yeah.
From the
then your awareness level's not high enough. No. So you got to tune up higher.
Yeah. Was that a bass? Was that a perch? Was that a striper? They have their own sound.
Was that a gar? Was that a carp?
Yeah.
You're right. They all have their own unique sound. Everything in nature does that. Every sound you hear should be information.
Yeah.
And you should be able to not just hear that, you should be able to read back through it. Mm-hmm. And if the blue jay squawks right here and you're trying to stalk a deer, he squawked, the blue jay squawks at you, then the crow, which is 100 yards away, squawks at you, then the deer, which is 200 yards away, he's reading through that. He's mm-hmm. reading through the crow, through the blue jay to you. Mm-hmm. So you got to be able to do the same thing.
Do you?
Fishing's the same way.
Yeah. When you kind of, let's say you just kind of hit the water, right? Are you running and gunning right out to say that first spot, or you just take a minute to kind of be?
Well, no, you don't do. You obviously, no, I'd actually probably the opposite.
Are you?
I study my maps. I study my seasonal patterns, and I pick out the area of the lake for that season, which I think has all the qualities to be one of the best areas. Now, we all make mistakes, but and then I go in that area and I stay in it until I figure the fish out.
Gotcha. So that
because with your... if I just run around, I'm not giving any spot a fair chance. I'm not getting in tune with that. So choose one or two of your best areas and then spend your time in there and let the fish in there tell you what the fish in the rest of the lake is doing.
Mm-hmm. And something we were talking about, some Livingston stuff the other day when I was visiting with you, and you talked about how when you're patterning, that you're weaving in and out from the break lines into the shallows. How do you pattern? Is that kind of your motif of working out deep, working in shallow? How are you kind of working an area so you're dialing in on where fish are holding?
Well, I guess, and you know, I'm trying to, yeah, because I don't want, and this is again very hard to do, and it is a mistake to do it. And that is, I don't want the past to influence me. Okay. Even though that past I'm relating to is very good information, but it's still intellectual information and it's the past. I want current information. So I would start doing it. A lot of people say the hard way, because I'm going to start kind of over and I'm going to try to, okay, are they, I'm going to start looking for all the indicators of what the fish are doing in this area. Mm-hmm. And by checking multiple depths, you know, by checking multiple clarities of water, by checking calm areas versus windy areas. And really then, you know, let that feeling of that area tell you what's going on. And then obviously you're changing lures. You're changing lures. And again, get rid of the term lures. You're changing tools. And your tools are to match the depth and the habitat that you're trying to fish efficiently, you know. So if you're fishing brush piles, you don't want it that are in 10-foot water. You don't want a 20-foot diving crankbait necessarily. Excuse me. Unless you're very good at fishing cover with crankbaits, and some people are. So you want to match the tools, and then, of course, then the fish hopefully start giving you some information. A lot of times you catch the first fish, maybe a pound and a half or a pounder. Mm-hmm. Just a little guy, and a lot of guys, oh, crap, he's too little. No, he may be too little for what your ultimate goal is, but he's still information. Mm-hmm. Every fish is information, so don't badmouth that little guy because he ain't big enough, you know.
Yeah.
So, He just gave you another piece of information. The next one's going to give you a little more, and on and on. So it's just a matter of collecting information and getting in tune with what's really going on in that area. And you're not just watching the fish. You're watching, I mean, the bass, or I'm going to use the bass because that's what I chase.
Yeah.
But you're checking for what its primary food is and what it's doing. You're checking for all the aquatic birds in that area. They're there for a reason, too. They're doing the same thing you are. They're trying to figure out where their prey is, and they're going to be where their prey is. And their prey is sometimes very much the same thing as the bass's prey. So if you figure out what the birds are, where they are, I can run up a creek in the fall, and all of a sudden you start seeing a section, a mile or two section of that creek that has a lot of aquatic birds.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge amount of information. They're not there just for recreational purposes. I mean, they're there because that's where the food is.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, being willing to look and observe that and pay attention. I mean, it's so huge. You said something that's superbly operative, and I kind of already know the answer to this, but how important is feel with your equipment? Because I know you're a one rod guy, right? Which is shocking to most. I mean, if you look at a bass boat now, I mean, there's what, 15 rods on the deck, every, you know, just right. Slews of crap everywhere, which is my favorite thing. I think you said it to me at ICAST. You said rod companies hate me, right? Because it's,
well, yeah,
you're not gonna, it's gonna be hard to sell a bunch of rods.
And in fairness to those with all the rods on the deck,
yeah,
remember the time frame I came from.
Right,
there
right.
Wasn't as many, there was not as many techniques as there are now.
Right.
And I, even what techniques were there, I focused on the winning techniques. Mm-hmm. And I knew you could catch, you know, bass on these other techniques, but I wasn't going to win with them. So I culled them. Mm-hmm. And so, and all the winning techniques for me, and again, it's my style, was power. And I used the same rod for that because, to me, rods, you develop an intimate relationship with every lure. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be good with it, you've got to be intimate with it. You've got to know how it feels when it's operating in its best, how it feels when it's going to generate the most strikes, and you've got to be able to duplicate that. The problem with changing rods is that intimacy is not as complex. Mm-hmm. In other words, because every rod you change changes your intimacy with that lure. If you're switching back and forth, and to me, I was a basketball player, and it was like you go to the free throw line, and the referee hands you a ball, and you shoot, and boom, nothing but net. But then when you go for your second shot, he hands you a different size ball,
mm-hmm.
and you go, crap. Well, yeah, you're good enough that you will adjust, but the problem is, in that adjustment, you're going to lose. You're going to miss several shots. The rod's the same way. In that adjustment, it's the only thing I want to have to adjust to when I pick up that next rod is the lure. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the one thing that will change. And but I don't want to have to adjust to the reel. I don't want to have to adjust to the speed of the reel. I don't want to have to adjust to the rod and its action. I only want to have to adjust to as the minimal things I need to adjust to be very intimate with what I'm doing.
Let me ask you this, this is a tough question. So let's say, because I'm 100% there, I'm a one rod guy, you know, preaching, screaming about feel, right? Which feels very hard to teach, right? It's very hard to explain feel. So that's what I'm going to ask you. For somebody that just heard what you said, which is 100% right, but they're not even perceiving that level exists. Do that make sense? Right. They're going, it's just a lure. It's just this. How do you kind of break through to somebody or get somebody on the path where they're going, okay, they start being observant of the lure enough to even feel it?
Well, that's it. It is. And that's time. And in fairness, that's time, you know, that you can remember the first time I ever tied on a certain lure. And the hardest one for me originally was a plastic worm.
Mm-hmm.
Because and you really will never, that process really doesn't even start that intimacy until you get that first bite.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden that wakes you up. Wow, right. Wait a minute. What, you know? And so then you start to analyze, what were you doing when you maybe caught that first fish?
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to try to duplicate it. And especially when you start to duplicate it, you've analyzed that feel. But what I would normally do with a young kid, if I am guiding him in the boat, and I know he's learning, even though fish is the most important thing to him, I would say, okay, you know, James, okay, this next cast, close your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, throw the bait out there, let it go to the bottom, and then start to work it back to the boat. Okay, and close your eyes and just try to visualize what that bait is doing. Is it in soft? Does it feel soft like it's in mud? Or is it in, feel hard like it's in rocks? Is it coming over or something like a stump or a log? And now, boom, it's falling off something. And so, and when you get back in, I want you to draw me, not physically, literally, but mentally, tell me what you felt like that lure was doing. And so that forces you to, again, the night fishing is one of the best times to learn feel. Mm-hmm. Even though I don't really like night fishing.
Yeah, I'm in bed by eight, but yes.
Yeah, right. But still, it is one of the very first times because it forces you to do that. And then eventually you take it even to the level, okay, I don't want you to feel what the bait's hitting. I want you to feel what the bait feels like. Mm-hmm. In other words, if it's a spinner bait, reel it fast and tell me what the blade, focus on the blade. Tell me what the blade feels like. Reel it slow and tell me what the blade feels like. Let it fall and tell me what the blade feels like. The most important thing on that bait is the water displacement of the blade. Mm-hmm. Okay. And eventually, like me with me, I kind of know 90% of the time the correct water displacement of the blade that's going to generate the strike. And that changes in different times of the year. It changes with different visibilities of the water. In other words, then you really, it starts to get complex. I said, first of all, when you are feeling the blade, what are you really doing that the fish is doing? You're feeling the blade, but the fish just doesn't, he's not feeling it the same exact way a human does. And yet maybe he is. He's feeling it through water. What in a bass detects water displacement? Lateral line. Yeah. And so that's what you're appealing to, the lateral line. And that's the most important thing in choosing the correct blade on your spinnerbait. Or the collect the, do you want a fine vibration on your crankbait, or do you want a real wide one that's shutting, that's with flat sides that's shoving? Like if you take your hand in the water and you move it back and forth, you're pushing a lot of water. Or if you make a fist and do the same thing, you're not going to push as much water. So you learn each one of your baits and what it's doing in the water displacement area. Learn, yeah, sight. That one is probably the most argumentative one of all of them. Mm-hmm. Because when is sight really a factor? With a bass, a largemouth bass, I'm going to say a largemouth, not a smallmouth, sight is rarely a factor. Mm-hmm. Okay, because he's a backwater fish, you know, slough. He grew up in sloughs and rivers. He didn't grow up in lakes because there weren't no lakes. Mm-hmm. And then we made lakes and he grew up in a lake and they've adapted. But still, they prefer non-moving water that's got color to it. That's the way they genetically, where a smallmouth, Great Lakes type fish, he prefers moving water sometimes that is very clear. So sight with that particular species is going to be a lot more important. If you want to play the color game, then play it.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's spot on. I mean, absolutely. So with, you know, the feel thing, it's so amazing. Like you're saying about feeling the blade, feeling the different vibrational profiles and, you know, dialing that in because it's so across the board. Something I wanted to ask you because you're so dialed in and understand it. How many fish have you set the hook on before they bent the rod? Tons. I'm betting. You know, I mean,
that's where being very, very in tune can, in a competitive standpoint, can hurt you.
Yeah.
My first classic that I won in 1976 at Lake Gundersville, the final day, I'm pumped. I took the lead. Mm-hmm. I'm broke. I know how important this event is. I've known it from the day I started this journey. And I'm about to win it. But the first four fish that hit me, I lost. And, of course, this is an overused term nowadays, but still it was very appropriate that my brain immediately, because I was, like I said, I studied everything, mm-hmm. the art of war, Einstein, and basically Einstein said, you know, you've heard this statement, the height of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Mm-hmm. And that hit me after I lost the fourth one. So I started really analyzing what every fish was hitting on the pulse,
mm-hmm.
which which, you know, is incredibly important and something we totally emphasize big time at Livingston, because people don't really consciously pay a lot of attention to it. But I was throwing a little bitty tiny crankbait down this riprap the final day, and the water was very off color, and I'd reel it down, and then I'd pause it and just hold, and then I could literally, when I felt the tick, I would set the hook, and I lost the first four in a row. And it hit me, and thank goodness, sometimes my brain works the way it's supposed to. It hit me, I'm fishing a rod that I broke that rule that you talked about earlier that I have never fished before. Skyline, all my rods back then had broken tips and new eyes put on the tips and everything. They were the 6 foot speed glass speed sticks. The Skyline Graphite has sent every classic guy 6 new rods. Mm-hmm. Most beautiful rods I'd ever seen.
Yeah, you're excited to get them. Yeah, like wow,
point in time. And that's all I took with me. And then it hit, and of course I'd read about them, and I agreed. I'd fished them enough that they were very sensitive. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was so in tune with everything that was happening that when I paused that bait, I was setting the hook when the fish was inhaling the bait.
Mm-hmm.
I could feel him moving the bait, and I'd set the hook. After that, every time I stopped the bait, I pushed my rod tip toward the fish, and I watched my line jump and never lost another fish after that. essentially, I was setting the hook when he was approaching the bait and just starting to suck it in, and I wouldn't allow him to do it because
right.
I was so in tune with what was going on, and then with these super rods I've never used.
Yeah, because the fish actually displaces water when he's about to strike, and yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. So, you know, you said one thing, and you know, it's super cool you're working with Livingston on the bass end of stuff, and it definitely crosses over into our stupid little musky world here about the pulse, you know, and that's one thing that you've kind of mastered. What's so important about the pulse just in general? Why is that so prevalent?
Well, it's I'm going to feed two things: the laws of conservation of energy, which again I studied everything I could possibly study, biological and everything, predator-prey relationships, and so I think the law of conservation of energy, first of all, says this is an opportunity. A bass is maybe he's sitting there, he's watching it. And if it just swim on by, he might not hit it unless he's super aggressive, but they're not super aggressive most of the day. So if he's not super aggressive and he's sitting there watching it, and all of a sudden it stops.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sits there for a second or two or three. Then he's finally, the laws of conservation energy is starting to say, this is pretty dang easy. This thing is committing suicide. So... You know, so you're encouraging him to take advantage of that. And the other one is predator-prey relationships. You know, and a lot of times when I pause is when I have bounced off from something, then I pause. Okay. Like with a, you know, a square bill or a coffin bill, and bounce off, then I pause. That indicates this may be hurt. I'm designed as a predator, as the dominant predator, to remove the weak, whether I'm hungry or not, mm-hmm. because that maintains the health of the herd, you know. And so that's all I'm trying to do with the paws. But I'm trying, and all anglers have caught fish doing that. Most of the time we weren't consciously aware of it. We just happened to happen. And some anglers are more aware than others, and they say, wait a minute. That fish hit it, you know, when I had stopped it. Either to scratch my nose or, you know, or mm-hmm. turn and look at the bird on the other shore, I paused. Boom, I got the strike. So, and again, this is part of the awareness that the fish is giving you information, you know, how they would prefer to attack the bait. So that's what I basically, there's other reasons that I don't even know. but the pause, I know. And so let's just get to reality and not theory. Because what I've given you is just theory.
Mm-hmm.
But reality, my own reality, has showed me some of the biggest bass I've caught, some of the biggest catches I've caught have been on the pause in my whole career. And I had over 100 pounds of falcon. Almost every one of those fish was on a square bill. When you jump through a bush and you'd stop it in the bush. Mm-hmm. Almost every one of those over, you know, had a 37-pound 5-fish limit one day and a 34-pound the other day. And so that was all pulse. The biggest string I've ever caught on a jerkbait was before jerkbaits were even suspending. We would make our own suspend by putting weights on. Mm-hmm. Was a 32-pound string on Kentucky Lake, and it was on the pulse. And it wasn't on just a little pulse. It was on a brain, you know, frustrating eight count.
Oh, come
they
on.
They would not hit if you didn't pulse it at least 8, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, 1,004. Being a fisherman, I almost have to have a case of Red Bull to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and then that doesn't help. We all have inadvertently have, you know, experienced the reality of the pulse.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's just... like you just said, the eight count. I mean, sometimes, you know, it's hard to slow yourself down, you know, and that's a self-control thing. That's crazy. An eight count, you know, and it's cool, guys. If you bass fish, and a lot of guys that listen to the show are multi-species. I think here shortly there's going to be some signature baits with the Rick Klun there at Livingston that's going to be cool, and they all have the EBS and. You know, it's kind of interesting. You've been seeing some cool results with the sound on the pulse, is what, you know, it seems to be the case.
No, because here's the problem with the EBS system. Okay. It's hard to take it past the theory stage. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I totally believe it's legit in the square bills and the coffin bills, the prime time 2.0. CBs and then the 1.5. I totally know it's legit with, you know, the jerk master jerk or jerk baits that we make. But here's the problem. It is very difficult to prove.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if the one bait, and it happened to me about 2 weeks ago on Grand Lake in Oklahoma, October. Was the walking boss. Mm-hmm. And the strike was incredible. But here was the problem with the strike. They were playing with it.
Yeah.
And they were playing with it on the pulse. And if I'd seen a fish hit on the pulse one day, yeah, just to be good to my sponsor, I would go, hey, look, he hit because of the EBS.
Right. Yeah. We all got to pay bills. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So, but is that enough?
No.
Is that a big enough sample size? Hell no.
No.
But what happened was it happened 6 and 7 times a day, 5 days in a row.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it. I'm looking at it sitting there when the fish comes up. Sometimes he comes up slowly. Sometimes he waits for you. Then sometimes he gets nervous. You can see him, and then you twitch it, and then he jumps over top of it. You know, he's playing with it. But if he plays with it long enough, I'm going to catch him.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, you know, and to your point, I mean, you look at that scenario Laker Howe was in where he's fishing basically – guys, I know it's on a bass podcast, but just to that point of what he's saying of like little small advantages, whether it be sound, whatever advantage it is, there's times anything can matter, you know. But I mean, Laker Howe won a tournament. He's got a guy set up essentially on the same spot throwing the same bait, but they had the one tiny difference of sound, you know.
Yeah, and Laker won one at Leech Lake, where in Minnesota, where I probably caught it. 2 biggest muskies of my life.
I'd imagine.
And I could not believe, and these fish were actually on a spinnerbait, so I'm not going to say they were on anything.
No, leech up in the shallows on a spinnerbait. Yeah,
they were so shallow.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe how big these fish, were big, big fish.
Yeah.
And they were in less than 2 foot of water.
All the time.
it kind of just blew me away, and I went, wow, I like this, you know. But yeah. I liked him until I had to land him and fight him and try to get my bait back.
Yeah,
I was not prepared for that.
Right. You got your 100-size bait caster and your bass rod. It's a fun fight. You know, yeah. It's funny when they stage like that of the hierarchy you see, you know, because with they're kind of bouncers. Muskies are kind of that, you know. They're the last person they'll let you in or out of the club. You know, they're kind of on the extreme edges of things. You know, like, we're not letting you in today. You know, you're good. Yeah. Go on in. All right. Nope. And so it's funny you see them so nasty shallow there. And I'd imagine you've ran into a ton of bycatch like that, but that's too funny. But Rick, we'll wrap her up here. I appreciate you slumming it up on a musky podcast. So, you know.
Stephen, I will never do another one of these. Okay. If you keep calling what you do slumming,
it's you don't understand how self-deprecating we are on this show. So.
Well, no, that's self-criticizing. But then I totally don't think that's slumming. That's like calling a trophy buck guy a slummer.
Well, yeah,
he may hunt for 4 years before he ever pulls the trigger. That's what he wants to do.
You know, I know all the fancy pants bass guys, and I often ask myself, Rick, did I have a head injury? Like, what did I do? Was I suffocated as a baby to end up as a musky fisherman? You know, but if you're gonna be dumb, you better be tough. So we appreciate you coming on here, buddy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephen.
Jay Bird, what do you think?
The man, the goat.
The goat. You can't do better than that, guys. If you didn't learn something there or it didn't click with you, listen again. Maybe fishing's not for you. If there wasn't something valuable there, maybe it's time to take up cribbage like we talked about earlier. Call the Smitty Cribbage Hotline. They'll get you lined up now. Fantastic. He's such a hoot to hang out with. And it's funny, Jay and I've laughed, and you know, one of Jay's friends, Brandon, you kind of, you know, you look at the goat.
Yeah, he's like, tell him I got his boat. Tell him I got his boat. Go, okay, Brandon.
I bought one of his boats. Yeah, I know.
He's hit two of them.
Really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Clun edition boats, yeah.
Wow. Frickin', you know, you've done something when you have your own edition of a boat.
Yeah,
you know, you're doing some very damage. Cool. But anyway, can't top that, Jay. Next week, we're going to have another guest on, believe it or not.
Whew.
And get to it. So we'll get to the Q&A. We're behind on some of that, but we'll stack it on for next week. I don't want to murky the water after something as biblical as Mr. Clun there. So.
Yeah.
All right, right. Jaybird, yeah. Say all right, guys. Good night.
Thanks a lot, guys. Have a good one. Thank you.
Problems I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a ski ain't one. 5 days, blue sky, high pressure, yo. Wind so light, ain't got no flow. Critics are saying my hold is low, but I was born in the hood, so the story goes. My Makota's stuck, it really blows. The hummingbird flashes with a gentle glow. Frable big game with the big old hole. If you don't like my lyrics, you can press fast forward. Blades clanging loud from the other boat. Ripping rubber too big, cause they think they know. Cut me off hard cause I'm fishing slow. Big motor just quit, now I gotta give him a tow. I don't know what you think you take me as, or understand the intelligence that Jaybird has. I'm from rags to riches, baby, I'm not dumb. I got 99 problems, but a ski ain't one. Hit me. I got 99 problems, but a ski ain't one. You're having bad problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a ski ain't one. Hit me.